On this episode of The Big Number, we take a deep look into the Spurs and Blazers matchup. Will it be a thriller or a mismatch between Victor Wembanyama and Denny Avdia? After that, we revel in the spectacle from Queen City as the Hornets beat the Heat, but not without controversy. We'll see what happens with LaMelo Ball. All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh. And as always, we are joined by my man, your man, Dan Devine. Dan, how's it going, man?
Tom, the first five-hour night of sleep, too much coffee night is in the books. The play-in tournament has begun. The postseason is officially underway. I was taking the action from the couch, but I believe you had a closer seat to the goings-on in Charlotte, North Carolina last night.
Yeah, dude, I'm telling you, that was one of the craziest days of the NBA schedule I've had in a long time. Because on one hand, I was at the Hornets game, the Miami Heat Hornets game. I used to cover the Miami Heat in Miami, and then they were coming to Charlotte for the play 9-10 game. So I had allegiances to both sides personally. And then at night, it was the Blazers on Amazon Prime with their kind of do-or-die play-in game. And so last night was bonkers for me. I had so many texts from people in my life, Dan, that were saying, dude, what a crazy game. I don't know which game they were talking about because right. It could have been both of them in that matchup between Suns, Blazers, and, of course, that epic finish in Charlotte. Queen City was just absolutely bonkers last night. So we're going to start with this new Portland Spurs matchup that we just got overnight. We're going to start there, but later in the program, we'll get into the Hornets' just thriller win over the Miami Heat, the Bam Adebayo controversy with LaMelo Ball. We'll get into all that later. But this week's big number, Dan, is 17. That is the number of months that has transpired since we have seen Denny Avdia and Victor Wembanyama start against each other. Yeah. 17 months since we've gotten this matchup, and we're going to get it here in the first round of the Western Conference playoffs. We've got the two-seeded San Antonio Spurs against the Portland Trail Blazers, a team that just beat the Phoenix Suns in a thriller. They were a 95% chance of losing that game late in the fourth quarter with the Phoenix Suns seemingly running away with it, and then Denny Avdia just took over the game. And like all these people, including ourselves, are trying to do a preview of this matchup. We've got 0 minutes this year of Victor Wembanyama playing against the Trailblazers. I'm going to say it again. Wemby has not played against the Blazers yet this season. So he's an MVP candidate. Denny Avdia is an All-NBA candidate, most improved player candidate, All-Star. They haven't played against each other. And stylistically, it's so fascinating because Victor Wembanyama is the greatest rim protector of this generation of the NBA right now. Maybe down the line will go down as the greatest defender ever to play basketball. But we don't know what it's going to happen with Denny Avdia, who's maybe the greatest downhill scorer that the league has right now. Most drives per game, most drive assists per game. And he had 41 points and 12 assists in that game against the Phoenix Suns that, yes, we're recording in history, even though the NBA does not observe those play-in stats. 41 points, 30 points via assist, because 12 assists, six of them were to three-pointers, like this one right here to Tamani Kamara in the left wing, his favorite spot on the floor. And this alley-oop to Shaedon Sharpe was one of the many that he's had this season, throwing lobs to whether it's Donovan Clingan, Rob Williams, or Shaedon Sharpe. Denny is a wrecking ball. And it reminds me, Dan, of the old rocks, paper, scissors thing where it's like, does rocks beat paper? Because Denny Avdia is the rock. He is the wrecking ball. They call him Turbo for a reason. And then you got Victor Wembanyama, who's 7'18", and he's going to be able to just defend the rim and just be lurking. And it might be the one antidote that we haven't seen for Denny Avdia this season is having that alien on the back line lurking. And stylistically, man, I can't wait for this matchup. I'm super happy for Rip City that they were able to get this win over Phoenix and then face the San Antonio Spurs in the first round.
Yeah, I mean, no spoilers, but Paper does cover Rock, and Victor Wembanyama covers just about everything. I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit more as we go on. But I mean, just to say, like, the point on Portland was that it's been a little bit shaky, especially on the road. You know, they go into Phoenix. They looked like the stronger team, certainly the bigger, more physical team for much of the game, where you got a lot of smaller guys on the Suns, and they're one sort of tried and true big that they feel comfortable with going with, like Mark Williams, was just being, you know, kind of being bodied up by Donovan Clingan, by Robert Williams. There was a physical, just like across the board advantage in size and athleticism. But the, you know, the Suns are able to generate some turnovers, get their threes going, get back into it. And so for Denny Avdia to be able to say, like, I'm going to grab this game by the scruff of the neck. He has not been in a whole lot of high leverage, high stakes matchups like that, where the level of intensity is really ratcheted up in that way. But for him to look like the best player on a floor that also featured Devin Booker, that, you know, that would also featured another former high pick in the draft and Jalen Green, that there was a lot of, somebody needed to take charge and take control of that game. And for him to do it and do it in the way that we've become accustomed to watching him, where it is, I'm driving right. Get spoiler, guys, I'm driving right. And you are not going to be able to stop me. You're not going to be able to force me to go back to my left. I'm going to get where I want to go. I'm going to get past the first line of defense, create the, you know, suck in the help. I'm going to create the angle that I want, create the contact. And then you're just going to have to hope I miss. That's basically what it's going to be, because I'm going to dictate the terms of engagement. That's what has made Denny Avdia an increasingly impressive player over the course of the last couple of seasons, certainly this year up to an all-star level. And as you mentioned, in consideration for some of the year-end awards, I think it will be very interesting to see what happens when that airspace is not, it's going to be a lot harder to come by, I think, in the next round. But even getting to this place, what a feather in the cap for a Blazers organization that has had a rough run of it the last few years, basically walking in the wilderness post that initial Damian Lillard trade, or even before that, really trying to sort of figure out how to reorient the organization. What do you build around now? The answer that we have is you build around this guy. And because the reason is, what's the sort of the straightest path between the ball and the bucket? It's Denny Avdia going downhill at the rim. And that certainly is the way that the Suns wound up on the receiving end of that last night.
Dude, it was incredible. And he does the thing that every coach wants in a player, is get two to a ball. He draws two to the ball, three to the ball, four to the ball. Sometimes five guys are all swarming on Denny Avdia. And he is the closest thing we have to LeBron and Luka Doncic in terms of a big downhill scorer that can spray to the corners and get guys on lobs. The downhill gravity that he has, it's unguardable. You saw the Phoenix Suns. They could not stay in front of him. He was powering through guys. He was getting the calls, and he was getting to the free throw line. But a lot of them, he was finishing at a high level. Denny Avdia led the league this season in and ones. Like, that is a Giannis category. Giannis being hurt this season opened up Denny Avdia. When you talk about downhill scores, guys who draw two, three guys to the ball, he's not only getting to the rack and finishing through contact, leading the league in that category, and doing it in the game winner down the stretch, getting that and one. It was one of those things that people, I don't think, are appreciating his playmaking skills. The 12 assists, the lobs, the kicking out to shooters, getting Jeremy Grant. Jeremy Grant leads the league in right corner threes this season, and a lot of it is because Denny Avdia knows that he's camping out there, and that's his favorite spot. And those corner, right corner threes that he hit against Phoenix, the game clincher, and all those moments, they've practiced this all season long. And Denny Avdia leads the league in drives, but also drive assists by a mile. And so when we talk about star players in the league, Denny Avdia is unquestionably a star player. He's making $14 million this season, and that goes to $13 next season, and $11 million in the season after that. So over the next 3 years, combined salary is like half of what a superstar makes in the NBA. And so for the Blazers, yeah, he might not be like an MVP right now, but in terms of these wrecking balls, the fulcrum of your offense, it's hard to find a better guy than Denny Avdia in a big moment against the Clippers last week. Two huge games against the Clippers to secure that 8 seed over them in the tiebreaker. And then this game, man, he certainly well-deserved moment for Denny Avdia.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen throughout the course of the season, obviously, that every team dealt with a ton of injuries. You know, you've certainly written and discussed that quite a bit over the course of the year. But you mentioned Jerami Grant, you know, had missed a chunk of time, just got back right before the playoffs. Scoot Henderson had missed a chunk of time earlier in the season. Shaden Sharp missed a significant amount of time. So you're seeing now, you know, Drew Holiday had missed a bunch of games. Like, you're seeing the Blazers kind of as theorized right now, where you've got a monster offensive rebounding tandem in Donovan Clingan and Robert Williams III to be able to clean up the misses on those Avdija drives. But also, he's not the only one that can get downhill like that. You know, Drew Holiday is a battering ram when he gets downhill and puts the shoulder into you. Scoot Henderson, super quick off the bounce, can get to the rim. Shaden Sharp, as athletic as it comes, getting off the wing. Jerami Grant can beat a closeout and get downhill. Tumani Kamara has advanced in that part of his game as well. So, like, all of these complementary pieces fit around Avdija in that way, where a lot of guys improving at, or excellent already at that, you know, the catch and shoot triple off of the kick, but also can put the ball on the deck, beat the closeout, and keep the machine moving. So you combine that with just positional size, which I know we've talked about a ton as a, you know, sort of a prerequisite for an elite defense at this point. You need to have that elite positional size across the board where you're not getting overwhelmed at the point of attack or having one guy that you can kind of hunt. They've got that across the perimeter spots. Drew Holiday obviously can guard up and has done that for years. Scoot Henderson deserves a ton of credit for the way he defended last night. I don't know that, I mean, it's certainly not a rampant, you know, topic of conversation. The improvement on the defensive end of a guy that was the number three pick a couple of years ago, but he has gotten better and better as the Blazers have improved on the defensive end. His hand was in there in the cookie jar all night, getting deflections. He was fighting over screens. He's face guarding Jalen Green, denying him the ball. They're active, they're physical, they're athletic, and there's size and length across the board there. And, like, that's going to be difficult to play against. I think, you know, we'll get into, you know, deeper components of the matchup from here on out, and there will be much more written and discussed about it. But obviously, the high-end talent advantage, you'd lean towards San Antonio based on the resume they've put together over the course of the season. But Portland's not a fun team to play against, because you're going to have to deal with a whole lot of shoulder blocks and a whole lot of, you know, getting up under your chin on both ends of the floor. And Avdija has been kind of the object lesson in that. He's the centerpiece of it, because dealing with him is a full-time job all night long. And over the course of a 7-game series, that can weigh on you, provided you can extend it further, which is going to be the challenge facing Portland against this excellent, excellent Spurs team.
The pressure that Denny puts on the defense is a skill. And the fact that he's able to have the conditioning to do that all the way through the end of the game, when you're tired, when you're physically and mentally exhausted and you're wearing thin and your patience is wearing thin, Denny just keeps going at you. And the same goes for Scoot Henderson defensively. He came into the league talking about how he wants to be surrounded by dogs. Like, he's a dog. He wants to get after it defensively. And you look at this Blazers team, they got all defense Kamara. They got all defense with Drew Holiday. They got all defense with Matisse Thybulle. They got all defense with Rob Williams. They got a guy who is very much in that all defense conversation in Donovan Clingan. They're so nasty to play against. The Blazers under Tiago Splitter, with that, those lineups, City Sissoko did a lot of it earlier this season, but they are guys that are going to be super physical. And I think they're very much tailor-made for playoff basketball, is that Tumani Kamara is going to be grabbing you, is going to be physical, and is going to be as in your face and shadowing the best player, covered more ground defensively than any player in the league over 100 miles. That's what, 4 marathons that he covered this season? Just he's all over you 94 feet on the floor. He's never zoning up. He's never just standing there and playing the zone or playing in space. He's always attached to someone. And you saw that with Scoot Henderson picking up all of those attributes from Tumani Kamara, who's picking up attributes about how to get these in the passing steals, pass interceptions from Matisse Thybulle. They're all kind of learning from each other. And it came together in those closing moments in the final seconds there against the Phoenix Suns. They go, the Phoenix Suns are going to play, now they're going to play for the 8th seed. Against the winner of the Golden State Warriors Clippers matchup. It's let's just take a moment here to recognize how cool it is to have, like, winner go home games, because the play-in yesterday on Tuesday was sensational. And I did note that so much of the injury reports that were, you know, a CVS receipt long over the last few weeks of the season, magically, it was the healthiest game for the Blazers, that the only guy who was missing was Damian Lillard for the first time all season. And on the other side, we had Dylan Brooks back. A lot healthier teams in these matchups. And hopefully we get that with the San Antonio Spurs. Dylan Harper, I should mention, left the season finale early with a thumb injury. Victor Wembanyama missed a few games there at the end with his rib contusion. And of course, has been battling kind of calf injuries throughout the season. So I'm really hoping that we get fully staffed, both teams healthy for this matchup. It's going to be great. And Victor Wembanyama, his playoff debut, Mitch Johnson's playoff debut, Tiago Splitter used to won a championship with the San Antonio Spurs, going against them in this matchup, sharing wine with Manu Ginobili and Boris Diaw the other night. There's a lot of storylines here, but the Denny Avdia rocks, paper, scissor battle with Victor Wembanyama, to me, that's going to be, if you're an NBA junkie or just someone watching the game, it's going to be the number one thing that's going to hit you every single play. Is how are the Blazers going to get downhill against Victor Wembanyama and that Spurs defense that walls up with Luke Kornet, that walls up with Victor Wembanyama, and it's going to be a battle, man.
Yeah, I'm really curious. As you said, we haven't really seen the full matchup for these teams. It's not just that Wembanyama hasn't played in any of these games. There's also been a couple of games without Stephen Castle and games without Devin Vassell and, you know, guys in and out of the lineup on both sides well for the Blazers. But just how do you start if you're San Antonio, right? The first question on how you deal with Denny Avdia is who's staring at him when he catches the ball. And I think when Stephen Castle was available, the one game he played, he picked up that matchup. There was Devin Vassell in the other two games that had the primary assignment, and just looking at the matchup data. But the one game, and so you say, well, Stephen Castle might be an all-defensive player. Like, he's guarded everybody, all shapes and sizes, 6'6", long, physical, nasty, strong. Like, makes sense as a guy that you'd want to throw on him. That was also the one game that the Blazers won, and Avdia wound up with a 29-10-10 triple-double. So it's, you know, one game sample is not indicative of anything in particular, but I think it might lead, you know, you wonder if that leads Mitch Johnson to wonder like, oh, what's our best answer for matching up here? And also, again, like, you didn't have Victor Wembanyama. Like, he is, if you can cross match him onto a less threatening player, a wing that's not a primary usage kind of guy, somebody that is more of a spot up shooter, then that allows him to sag off that guy and just be in the paint and show that help in behind Denny Avdia the entire time. Like, it's tough to do that if you've got all those guys in the Blazers that are capable of knocking down those shots, right? Like, there's no real weak link in terms of a guy that can't do anything with the ball. I guess they have dabbled last year a little bit in putting him on Tumani Kamara. Is Tumani Kamara now, has he improved enough to where he's going to be able to punish that? You know, if you leave him alone out there, or if you make him do something off the dribble, is he going to be able to get downhill and do that? The presence of Drew Holiday as another guy you've got to honor either on the perimeter or as somebody you can create, does that change the matchup? There's just a lot of interesting dynamics to this that, as you said, we haven't seen because it's been 17 months since we've seen the two, you know, all-star caliber players here lining up against one another. And I think we'll all be learning a lot together based on what these staffs think of, like, what do we got to take away and how best do we do that? Certainly the answer from San Antonio's perspective is we got to figure out how to make Denny Avdia play left-handed. I guess maybe like literally, but also figuratively, like, how do we move him away from just constantly being able to get downhill? What's our best answer for doing that? And I think having the big fella back there ought to help quite a bit.
Yeah, there's something about Victor Wembanyama that I want to make mention here. He's not just the best shot blocker in the game, but with that, he's the best shot blocker without fouling. And those are two very distinct skills or traits in the league. We see a lot of times that elite shot blockers are going to just inevitably foul the opponent because of how physical they are, or because they have to kind of get closer to you because they don't have the certain length in order to get that rim protection. I want to relay this stat here on Victor Wembanyama and his kind of like all-time greatness already in the shot blocking category. Among the 294 players with at least 500 blocks to their resume, there's only six of them that have more blocks than fouls. Okay. So think about that. 288 of the 294 players all time with at least 500 blocks have more blocks, sorry, more fouls than blocks. I'll give you a couple examples here. Hakeem Olajuwon has minus 553 net blocks. Net blocks, I mean, just blocks minus fouls. He is minus 553. Okay. Patrick Ewing, minus 1,100. He has 2,800 blocks and 4,000 fouls. Shaquille O'Neal, minus 1,400. Alonzo Mourning, one of the greatest defensive bigs ever. He's minus 454. Dwight Howard, minus 1,600. Brooke Lopez, minus 875. Kevin Garnett, minus 1,500. You get the idea. Victor Wembanyama is one of those six that has a positive net blocks on his ledger. So he has 627 blocks and just 414 foul calls against him in his career. That plus 213 in that column is second all time to another really long, tall guy, Manute Bol. Manute Bol had 2,086 wow. blocks and 1,400 fouls. So his record is plus 629. Victor Wembanyama, plus 213. David Robinson, also San Antonio, legend, plus 119. Mark Eaton, plus 109. Ben Wallace, 59. And Eddie Griffin, plus 12.
Wow.
Right there on the cusp of that positive side on the net blocks ledger. So, damn, that's going to be huge in this series because Denny Avdia wants to get you in foul trouble, wants to go into your chest in order to draw the foul. And a lot of times, if he gets past Stephon Castle or they funnel him to Victor Wembanyama, Denny's going to try to get you in foul trouble. That's what he does every single night in the NBA, is trying to get the opposing big man in foul trouble. And he does it at a top three rate in the NBA. And Victor Wembanyama, it's strength against strength. He hates to defend with that kind of physicality. And you see it in the numbers. He's one of six players all time that has more blocks than fouls. And we'll see how that changes dynamics with Denny Avdia. But like you said, Wemby straight up hasn't played this year against the Blazers. And last year, when he played against the Blazers, Denny was coming off the bench, not a fully formed Denny Avdia yet. And so I can't wait to see this matchup.
And Denny Avdia wasn't fully formed yet, nor were the San Antonio Spurs. And I think the best indication of just the level of jump up in competition here, no disrespect intended to the Phoenix Suns, but the Spurs have not lost consecutive games since before Indiana beat Miami in the college football playoff national championship game, which was about three months ago, January 19th, that was. The last time the Spurs lost two games in a row was January 11th and the 13th, a one-point loss to the Wolves, I believe on a Anthony Edwards buzzer beater, or game winner, rather, and then a big loss, like the get-back loss to the Thunder in 1998. Since that time, they have not lost consecutive games. They have a record of 35-9, including 19-3 at home. They have outscored their opponents by nearly 12 points per 100 possessions. And with Victor Wembanyama on the floor, that goes up to 20.2 points per 100 possessions in that span. So, you know, good luck to the Blazers. You are probably going to need it as you level up here against the Spurs. But as you mentioned, the best version of this game for the series for the Blazers probably rests on trying to like dictate the terms of engagement with their physicality. And Denny Avdia is a pretty damn good place to start with that.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible performance from Denny and the rest of the Blazers. We'll get into more on this matchup here coming up after the break with Dan, your three little numbers. This week's big number is 17, the number of months that we have seen. It's been since we've seen Denny Avdia and Victor Wembanyama starting against each other. So this is going to be a blind matchup for these two teams. A lot of missing parts in the regular season. But there are some numbers that we can kind of pull at that will dictate, I think, this series. What is your first little number with this matchup between the Spurs and the Blazers?
Yeah, we're going to double the big number to go little, which is a little odd now that I say it that way. But first little number this week is 34.8, a little more than double 17. That's what the Trailblazers as a team shot on jumpers during the 2025-26 regular season, according to Synergy Sports Technology. 34.8% on jump shots is 29th in the NBA, ahead of only the Brooklyn Nets, which is not great, not the kind of comparison or the company you want to be keeping this time of year. As we just wind up discussing, the Blazers do their best work on the interior. It's the downhill drives, it's the offensive rebounds and putbacks, and that all shows up in the team-wide data. Fifth in the NBA in the share of shots that come directly at the rim, tied for third in offensive rebounding rate, first and second chance points, fouls drawn on drives, assists per game at the rim, all those sorts of things that we talked about with what leads Denny Avdia into that all-star conversation. And I think the problem, as we've discussed a little bit, that we run into is that Victor Wembanyama tends to vaporize a lot of those up-close point-blank tries in the interior game. The Blazers for the season took more than 35% of their field goal attempts at the rim, which is a top five rate. With Victor Wembanyama on the floor, Spurs opponents take just 26% of their shots at the rim, which is a bottom four rate. So at the risk of oversimplifying things, if Wembanyama is in there and you can't get to the rim as easily, you're going to wind up having to take a lot of jump shots. And that isn't really the game of a Trailblazers team that shot 34.8% on jumpers for the season.
Yeah, we've been tracking this all season long, is that when the Blazers hit their shots, they're one of the best teams in the league. They're 22-9 this year when they shot above league average from downtown, 36%. And guess what they shot in that game against the Phoenix Suns? 36%. So they got the win because they were able to hit their shots. And when I think they're a top eight team in the league when they're shooting 40%, meaning when all the teams shoot 40%, what is your record? And that's really a huge swing factor because the defense is always going to be there, like you point out. The defense is always going to be there for the Blazers. It's just whether they can actually space the floor and capitalize on those Denny drives. And I think a lot of this has been unlocked lately with the vertical spacing that Donovan Clingan and Rob Williams have had with Denny Avdia, is those corner defenders have to kind of sink down to stop that lob. And you're getting more open threes for some of the guys in the corners, like Jeremy Grant in the right corner as he hit that one to go that huge shot down the stretch. And so it is kind of this, if they can get elite three-point shooting, which is why I was so big on the Veet Krejci acquisition, because he was one of the best three-point shooters in the league for the last couple of years with Atlanta and hasn't found his stroke yet with the Blazers. And so if they can get just some punch from the perimeter against the Spurs, it'll be a series. But it is just so hard to do that when you're facing Victor Wembanyama and he's walling off the paint. You're going to have a lot more contests. It's so much easier to defend the paint when you got Victor Wembanyama. It seems so obvious, but what that does also, it doesn't allow for the Blazers to get the defense in a blender, right? You want to get those rotations happening when you have Wemby or Lou Cornette on the back line. It's a lot harder to force those rotations and get open shots. But Tamani Kamara leads the league in spot up threes. And so when you're able to get those kickouts to Tamani and he's shooting at a 37-38% clip, there are going to be some good, like high highs with the Blazers. But again, if they're not shooting well, it's ugly for the Blazers, and they just have to figure out a way to get that perimeter attack.
Yeah, and you know the regular season matchups bore that out. In the two Spurs wins this season, Portland went a combined 21-for-73 from three-point range, just under 29%. And in the one win over the Spurs this season, 19-for-45. So make or miss league, you know, sometimes it's a little bit of a reductive bit of analysis, but things become cliches sometimes because they're true. You got to make your jump shots if you want to be able to win in the NBA. Second little number this week, you talked about the impact of Donovan Clingan and Robert Williams. This kind of touches on that. Second little number is 18.4. That's how many second chance points per game the Blazers averaged this season. As I just mentioned, that was number one in the NBA ahead of the Charlotte Hornets, Houston Rockets, Detroit Pistons, and everybody else. San Antonio, on the other hand, only allowed 13.7 second chance points per game this season. That was fourth fewest in the NBA. Which again kind of stands to reason because Victor Wembanyama leads the league in defensive rebounding rate. You have a 7-foot million a guy standing back there, it's going to be easier for him to get to the ball first, generally speaking. And I think that's a pretty interesting potential bellwether to watch here. You know, it's because, and I think this has been a discussion point for a lot of X's and O's folks over the last couple of years. It's not just your bigs going to the offensive glass. It's everybody, right? It's the corner crash rate. It's how many are you sending two or three guys to the boards to try to rest that possession game in your favor. So it's not just wrestling with Donovan clinging down low for Victor Wembanyama. It's also, it's Chris Murray diving in off the rim. It's Drew Holiday trying to, you know, sneak behind the defense. It's Tumani Kamara, you know, diving in from the corner or from the above the break on those slot cuts. All those guys trying to like bombard the rim to create those second chance opportunities. Which team is able to kind of dictate that traffic jam? Is it going to be the Spurs able to finish a possession, get the ball going the other way before Portland's able to get their defense set? Or is it going to be the Blazers forcing the Spurs to scramble and then get a second stop or a third stop? And in the process, frankly, banging Victor Wembanyama around a fair amount, you know, like sending the bodies to him, making him deal with the physicality, not just when he has the ball on offense to get to his spots or down low, but also trying to just clear the boards on the other end. I think if the Blazers want to have a chance there, a decent chunk of it's going to have to come from, can we, you know, rough this up a little bit? And we know we're very good at doing that, and that's where a decent chunk of our offense comes from. We're going to have to crank that up even another step to be able to deal with the defensive rebounding of Wembanyama and kind of push the game onto our terms.
Second chance points is always just such a funny stat for me because I'm like, well, that probably means the first chance didn't go for it very well.
Sure. So, right.
The Blazers have the 29th field goal percentage in the NBA. And so a lot of the reason why you see so many second chance points for them is because they're not hitting their first chance opportunity. But they also do this one thing well. Donovan Klingon, obviously, with the putbacks, and Rob Williams with the putbacks and the finishes around the hoop. But they also are second in the NBA, the Blazers are, in most made threes off of offensive rebounds. Tiago Splitter calls them dagger threes, yep. Threes, whatever you want to call it. The Charlotte Hornets do this more than anybody, is once you get an offensive rebound, Moose is going to kick out to Kobe White or kick out to Con Knipple, and it's just going to be a dagger three. Heartbreaking for the defense to have to finish a possession with a guy getting an offensive rebound and kicking out to a three-pointer. Blazers love doing this, but they haven't really been shooting all that well on those dagger threes. Yes, they lead the league or a second in the NBA in dagger threes, but they're shooting just 35% on those open three-pointers off of those second-chance opportunities. But in a seven-game series, all you need is a couple of those hot nights after those second-chance opportunities, kicking out and hitting those free threes, that it will potentially tilt a series. So it's a lot harder to do that if you're turning the ball over and you're not getting even the first chance opportunities, which has been kind of the issue for the Blazers. Wonder, do you have anything on that, Dan?
Yeah, it's our third and final little number this week, which is 15, as in 15%, a turnover rate of 15%. When the Portland Trailblazers have turned the ball over on 15% or fewer of their offensive possessions in a game this season, 19-7 record, which is a very good record. That's like a 60-win pace. There's just one problem with that. And I ran it by the Elias Sports Bureau to make sure my math was right. That's only 26 games, and the Blazers have played 83 now this season, which means they've turned the ball over on more than 15% of their possessions, a hell of a lot more than they've avoided it. The Blazers have the highest turnover rate in the NBA this season. And when they cough it up on more than 15% of their trips, they're 24-33, which is not very good. San Antonio, for the record, doesn't force a ton of turnovers. They're not like a super aggressive defense like Phoenix or like some of the other teams that you might see in the really Toronto really cranks up the pressure. The Spurs force turnovers on fewer than 13% of their defensive possessions, which is like bottom three in the league. But there's a reason, you know, as you mentioned, they can funnel everybody into the abyss waiting inside for them in Victor Wembanyama. So they don't have to necessarily press up or crank up the doubles in the same way. It's worth noting, though, that in Portland's two losses to the Spurs this season, 34 total turnovers leading to 47 San Antonio points in those two losses. And in the one win, only 11 turnovers, leading to 9 Spurs points. So again, these are fairly simplistic ways of getting at it a little bit. But if you don't turn over the ball and you get more shots on goal and you get more opportunities to maybe generate those second chance points, got a better chance of coming away from those possessions with some points on the board. If you don't, especially live ball turnovers, if you're coughing it up and giving the Spurs the opportunity to go run the other way, Stephen Castle doing chin-ups on the rim or generating 3-on-2s that lead to open threes for guys like Julian Champagny or Devin Vassell, then it's a tough sledding against an already, a team, basically a Spurs team that doesn't need your charity. You can't afford to give them any of it.
That's exactly right. This might be the biggest equation that we need to follow in this series is the turnover rate for the Blazers. And it's something that on the Phoenix Suns broadcast or the coverage that I was doing leading up to this game, it's the thing I harped on the most was if the Blazers take care of the ball, they're an elite team. And when they don't, they're just another team. It's as simple as that. And lately, with Scoot Henderson and Jrue Holiday in the backcourt starting, the Blazers' turnover rate has plummeted, right? So a lot of this for the Blazers is just making sure that they have multiple ball handlers out there, that they don't make, extraneous passes or anything, just kind of a flip pass here and there that tends to bite them. Against the Spurs and the length that they have in the backcourt and how fast they are, it can get over quickly if they're not able to be much better with taking care of the ball. And that's, that's the case with every team. But when we talk, I think it was Zach Cram over at ESPN had written a story about how every team wants to play fast, but then it also lends itself to more turnovers and you get a little bit in disarray where the Boston Celtics slow things down and they have the lowest turnover rate or right up there in the NBA. And they're complete opposites of the Portland Trailblazers. And against this San Antonio Spurs team, we tend to think that things slow down in the postseason, but I don't think that's going to be the case with Victor Wembanyama back there. I think they're going to want to get out and run and use that De'Aaron Fox lever as much as they can with those turnovers. So that has been the Achilles heel of the Blazers all season, is trying to keep those turnovers in check. And part of that is Deni Avdija had to play point forward without Jrue Holiday or Scoot Henderson so much of this season. And the only other ball handler they had was Caleb Love, who was on a two-way contract. And so a lot of those high turnover games were because they just didn't have a pure point guard out there. But now with Scoot and Jrue Holiday in the starting lineup, a lot of that has calmed down and they're getting much healthier possessions. I think they had 15 turnovers against the Phoenix Suns, and anything in that neighborhood, 15 or fewer, the Blazers will be in good shape.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the multiple ball handlers being a way to kind of defray the concerns there. San Antonio, an object lesson in that, right? A lot of people headed into the season concerned, like, how are they going to share the ball and figure everything out with De'Aaron Fox alongside Stephen Castle and Dylan Harper? And the answer is, like, actually having more guys that can dribble is a good thing, and more guys that if somebody's shutting off your primary creator, somebody else that can get the ball swung to them and deal with full court pressure or get the ball where it needs to go, get you into a set. De'Aaron Fox also, just as a side note, 27 points per game against the Blazers this season. And I think part of that is, just as we mentioned, no Wembanyama, who else was in and out of the lineup. But Fox, super comfortable. I think it was 27 points, about 6 assists, 6 rebounds, and 3 steals per game against the Blazers this season. Shot 48% from the floor, 44% from 3, which is a real swing number for him, and then 90% from the foul line, and able to get downhill, even against some of those quality wing defenders that the Blazers can bring to bear. So we haven't seen Fox in the postseason the last couple of years. There was that one first round series with the Kings against the Warriors where he was going toe to toe with Steph and then broke his finger. There was the play-in games with the Kings the following year, and then obviously didn't go anywhere last year when he got moved from Sacramento to San Antonio. They didn't make the postseason. So I'm interested to see what he looks like back in that context as a number two, as opposed to being the primary creator now, and how the matchups line up. Because as you mentioned, there's there's no shortage of really good perimeter defender options on the Portland Trailblazers starting lineup. And so it's a question of where do you put everybody, right? Where the X's and O's, where do you line everybody up? Because the Spurs have a bunch of guys that can get to their own shot and create for somebody else. And the Blazers have a bunch of guys that you can throw on to sort of shut somebody's water off. I think this, as you, I mean, you called it the rock, paper, scissors. The styles make fights component of this, I think, is going to be really interesting. Like, I don't think, I think, again, you look at this from the top down 30,000 foot view, and it's like the Spurs should be comfortably favored in this series, but I do not think it is going to be a comfortable series. I think Portland can make this hard in ways that, you know, if you're a Spurs team that doesn't have a whole lot of experience, you need to go through something like this to be able to move on to the next step. But it's going to take some doing to get there, because I don't think the Blazers are going to make it easy on them, especially if they can hold on to the ball.
Yeah, the Blazers, they've knocked off the Thunder when they went 24-1. The Blazers were the team that had the win over the Oklahoma City Thunder. They've beaten the Spurs. They've beaten just about every team in the league. So they're highest of highs. They can take down anybody, but it's a question of whether they can beat this Spurs team four times in a seven-game series. I actually think the Spurs have a really good chance at winning this whole thing. I think Victor Wembanyama is that good, and I also think that playoff experience is overrated. Recently, there's a column going out on Yahoo Sports today that I wrote about how increasingly we're seeing that postseason experience is turning into postseason tax. Is that guys with a lot of miles on their tires, it is actually that quote-unquote experience that we thought was a feature is now turning into a bug. And so for San Antonio, looking at the last seven champions have all been new champions or no repeats in the last 7 years, they could be the eighth one in that line simply because the injury factor creates so much variance in the postseason now and parity. And as much as I want to say the Thunder should be the head and shoulders favorites in the Western Conference, the NBA is changing and the postseasons are changing, and that injury variable where all-stars are getting injured more often in the postseason than ever. I think the San Antonio Spurs can do this. And we want to say, hey, they need that experience. They're not ready yet. They haven't even played as a playoff unit yet together. De'Aaron Fox, as you mentioned, not the most seasoned guy in the postseason atmosphere, but with the Thunder winning it all last year, that meant that the seven series after the first round, Dan, the lesser experienced team went 7-0 after the first round.
Wow.
So we like to think that experience is a virtue, but oftentimes we're actually seeing this flip on its head, that the younger teams in a faster NBA, the younger teams that don't have as much tax on their mileage, it seems like the San Antonio Spurs could actually be a giant, a sleeping giant here. And too bad for the Blazers, because this is a tough matchup for anybody. But against with Deni Avdija and Victor Wembanyama and Donovan Klingon, the number one offensive rebounder in the NBA, it's a different calculus going against Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs. So just want to throw that in there, that this experience variable, Dan, as you've been covering the league, we used to think that you needed to be experienced in order to win a title. And recently, just the Indiana Pacers running all the way to the NBA Finals last year and almost winning the whole thing, those Cinderella runs are becoming more common than we think, because a lot of stars are getting injured, and that just creates variance. And San Antonio Spurs, this might be the start of something really special.
That's a pretty tall Cinderella. I don't know if we've ever seen in any of the productions, the live actions or the Broadway shows or anything.
The glass Cinderella slipper. What size shoe is that? What size is that glass slipper?
You know? That's right. You know what? Let's keep any glass away from the feet of the giant French guy. We don't want anybody slipping or cutting themselves or anything. No, thank you. We're healthy now. Man. Let's stay that way.
Let's stay on our feet, which is what we're going to talk about here in the next segment. The Hornets and the Miami Heat. What a thriller in the Queen City. We'll talk about that one right after the break here, as we step away from the Spurs-Blazers matchup. We'll see what happens with the Charlotte Hornets, who they're facing. But man, we got to talk about this. So as you mentioned at the top, I was at the game in Charlotte at the Spectrum Center in downtown Charlotte, which we call Uptown here. It felt like the whole city was in that arena. Like, you have to remember, the Charlotte as an NBA city was like the crown jewel. And I don't say this just because it's the Queen City and there's a lot of crown kind of iconic iconography. Thank you. All of the symbols of Charlotte. Thank you, Dan. Are crowns. And for the NBA, when the Hornets came into the picture, they led the NBA in attendance for 8 of the first 9 seasons of its existence. And they had sellouts in 371 straight games at the Coliseum. It's no longer there. They moved out of the city to New Orleans. The attendance dropped to 29th in the NBA for the Hornets in New Orleans. And then they brought back the Bobcats, and the Michael Jordan era was not great, but he did bring back the purple and teal and the throwback uniforms and the name. And man, it felt like old times again. Dan, the place was rocking in that game. And what a game between those two teams, with Eric Spoelstra on one side and Charles Lee, who's up and coming and has this amazing second half run that we talked about on this program. It was a roller coaster, that game. And so as you're watching it, Dan, here's the view from where I was sitting. Steve Ashburner from the NBA, NBA.com, and I were sitting next to each other at this view. If you can't tell it from this, if you're not watching it at home and you're just listening, but even if you are watching, it's kind of hard to see. What was lost in this video of the closing seconds in that overtime win for the Hornets was a referee just trucked some fans that were so excited over LaMelo Ball's layup. They ran onto the court, and I think it was Petraeus, he was trying to run back to follow the play as Davion Mitchell was going down the floor, and he just ran over 3 fans because they were going nuts, so excited that LaMelo hit that layup, and he trucks them. And then after the block from Miles Bridges and the rest of the Hornets just like completely smothered that layup, LaMelo Ball is just screaming, going nuts. And he, like the Hugo the Hornet, runs out onto the court, and LaMelo just like socks him right across the face. And like the Hugo the Hornet is just like, whoa, oh God. It was the most insane thing. And even watching the video, I didn't pick up on those things. Because in real time, you're just like, oh, I can't believe the Hornets just won that game. They had a 98% chance, Miami did, 98% chance of winning late in the fourth quarter. Thing on unpredictable.com that was excitement factor. Like they have a metric that tries to quantify the excitement in a game. And basically, if you look at that win probability graph, how long is that line if you just kind of stretched it out? And if you have a really exciting game, that win probability line is just going back and forth, right? Like a heartbeat. And in this game, it was 27th out of 1,233 games this year. That game between the Miami Heat and the Charlotte Hornets ranked 27th out of 1,233. So one of the most exciting games of the year. And I would dare say one of the most exciting wins in Charlotte history. And I know the jokes are already writing themselves. There's not too many of those big games in the Charlotte Hornets history, but I would say that was one of the best games I've ever been to, most exciting, and certainly in my hometown, I will not forget that game. That was incredible, Dan.
Yeah, and you know, there will be time. There's been plenty of time to throw shade at the Hornets. Like maybe not right now. This is inarguably, they've been awesome for months, and inarguably that was fun as hell. And you can quibble with the how sound some of the decision making and some of the playmaking was at different points down the stretch. And, you know, there's people to blame and people to credit and whatever. But like when you're just, if you are a neutral observer and you are just tuning in to see postseason basketball, these games being decided on like hero shots in the final seconds and, you know, incredible swooping in for blocks and incredible dives to the rim and finishing in traffic and all, like that's kind of all you're looking for, right? And so yeah, the Hornets, they play a chaotic brand of basketball exemplified to an incredible degree by LaMelo Ball, who finds himself at the center of the conversation in a number of directions, some good, some bad, but is it maybe the NBA's premier maximalist? The feeling of like, you know, Russ post KD of like, he's going to be involved in every possession and it's going to be loud. Every single one of them in ways that are good or bad. Things will happen that you've never seen before. Things will happen that make you leap out of your seat. Things will happen that make you tear your hair out. things that will happen that make you feel like you need to curse in your off air, your walk off interview. Things will happen where you decide where, and discussing the post game things like, I don't know what a concussion is. Like there's a lot of stuff that happens with LaMelo Ball and you don't always know exactly what it's going to be. But game winner, almost a game losing turnover, I think 30 points on 31 shots, you know, but also like some of the biggest shots, that keeping them connected in the first half when nobody else was making shots. Like it was all quite something. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, heading into the break and coming out of like, one of the things that we have to talk about is, yeah, LaMelo Ball goes and he attacks the rim and he is able to get that game-winning layup. Who's not on the floor when that happens? Bam Adebayo. And there's a reason Bam Adebayo is not on the floor. And again, LaMelo Ball finds himself at the center of the discussion.
So I think it was a dirty play. I think it certainly looked bad. In real time, we didn't quite see it happen. Like in the arena, there was no instant replay of the play. We just saw Bam Adebayo go down hard. And from my vantage point, I couldn't obviously see from across the arena the angle in which LaMelo scoops his ankle and as he's falling down, accelerates his hit to the floor and his tailbone. It looks so painful just by watching that. You can almost feel it from across the arena. Bam Adebayo, as huge as he is, hitting as hard as he did. He didn't get right back up. And that guy is tough as nails. Bam Adebayo. He's been through some stuff in life. For him to be writhing around on the ground, I saw Pat Riley, Alonzo Mourning, and Adam Simon, who's the assistant GM for the Miami Heat. They were sitting in the arena, and I immediately looked over to them. They're standing up. And they're looking at Bam because I think they realize if he's still down on the floor, he's hurt. Like he's in a lot of pain. This highlight here from I think last year, a couple years ago, where Bam Adebayo is trying to run back on defense and LaMelo Ball scoops up and tries to trip Bam Adebayo as he's running back. It's part of whatever the NBA is going to review here. This highlight, again, from a couple years ago. The NBA is going to have to review this, and Chris Haynes is reporting that they are going to review this incident with LaMelo Ball. The question is whether the NBA is going to suspend him for a game, which would be the play-in game, the do-or-die game that they're going to go on the road to either face Philly or Orlando, or are they going to come in with like a flagrant one infraction, just kind of post hoc call? It's a tough one, and Eric Spoelstra has to kind of like walk a fine line here because he knows the rules that if there's no foul call, they can't review the play. And so there really wasn't that trigger for the NBA officials. And Curtis Blair, he's looking at that. He's right there seeing the play. His head is looking down at the play. I don't know if he was obscured, that he didn't see it. But if you're a Miami Heat fan, I think you're really in pain today because they did not have Bam Adebayo. And Khalil Ware, as good as he was on the boards, he's not Bam Adebayo, who's one of the premier defenders in the league. And you're right. So much of that, those plays at the rim would be snuffed out by Bam Adebayo. And here's Spoelstra's comment. I don't think it's cute. I don't think it's funny. I think it's a stupid play. It's a dangerous play. LaMelo should be penalized for that. He should have been thrown out of the game for that. I don't have any rebukes of that. If you're Eric Spoelstra and you're the opposing coach, I totally get why you feel like they missed that. And if you're going to take out Bam Adebayo on a dirty play, I don't care who it is. This is not a Hammurabi's code, eye for an eye type thing, but I think it's very important to note that Bam Adebayo is the single most important player on that Miami Heat roster. It's not even close. And without him, the fight that they had was a classic Miami Heat team to fight back and keep that game close without their guy.
Absolutely. And our pal Cooper Moorhead covers the Heat for Heat.com has a great like kind of stark numerical look at this. Bam only got 11 minutes in this game. And in those 11 minutes, the Hornets scored at an offensive rating of 90.9, which would be, you know, bottom of the NBA by a million miles. And in the 42 minutes that Bam wasn't available, the Hornets scored a 135 offensive rating, which would be best in the NBA by a million miles. And of course, like small samples and yada, yada, yada. But it puts a fine point on it. Like when Bam's there, the Heat are an excellent defense, an elite defense. When Bam's not, they're not. And Some of that is just with the way he can protect the rim. Some of it's with the way he switches. Some of it's with the defensive rebounding, which was a huge problem when he wasn't there. The Hornets, I think, 17 or 18 offensive rebounds, 25, 26 second chance points. Like, that was a big sort. Moussa Diabate, the energizer, the way he was extending possessions, all that, like, Bam not being there plays a huge factor in that. And then, you know, it's all like insult to literal injury that, like, it's not just that LaMelo kind of gets away with that from the Heat's perspective and then is able to continue. He's the guy who hits the game winner. So, like, yeah, you certainly can understand Spoelstra having that strong reaction to it. I don't know that there's anything the league's going to be able to do after the fact to kind of ameliorate that. Like, it's a little bit of the toothpaste out of the tube here from the Heat's perspective. But yeah, looking forward, you know, we've talked on this show about, as much as, you know, there's credit to be given to Brandon Miller and to Moussa Diabate and to Konka Knipl and to other players and coaches and everything else, LaMelo Ball is the swing factor for the Charlotte Hornets. When he's on the floor, the offense is elite. When he's not, it's not, generally speaking. And so, like, if he's not available to go on Friday for whatever reason, you know, say an after-the-fact suspension, I would be very surprised if that's the result here, but I guess you can't rule anything out. That's a dramatic shift in what the likelihood of the Hornets advancing would be. And if you don't, you know, the Hornets, I think we've all talked about this, like, the idea of the Hornets have been a top five team in the East for months, like, them making it into the eighth seed to be able to take on the Pistons, like, that's, I think, the matchup people really are excited about potentially seeing, especially if you're looking at, like, a Philly team that might, that's not going to have Joel Embiid now that he's had the emergency appendectomy, or, you know, good Lord knows what's going on with Orlando. That team has certainly seemed haunted for much of the season and down the stretch here, but, like, that's kind of what we're looking for. But pending this review and pending the outcome on Friday night, you know, an awful lot's up in the air, and that's not, I don't think that's the headline anyone would love to have coming out of such an exciting, such a compelling game looking forward. But also, like, again, it's inarguable. You cannot look at the way that that game concluded and the back and forth nature of it, the way that Charlotte was able to come back and get to its shots, get buckets late, the Heat having to go to their zone so often in the fourth quarter to like wrong foot or Charlotte to get them off their rhythm, was they weren't going to be able to get stopped any other way without Bam back there. So unfortunate to not be able to see it be both teams at full strength with their full complement of star players. That's sort of where we have to leave it for right now, I suppose.
127. That was your little number last week. That is the Hornets offensive rating in the minutes that they play with LaMelo Ball off the floor and Kobe White on the floor. Dan, go take your victory lap on this one, because Kobe White was unfreaking believable in this game. The three that he hit in the corner, because he tried to get it off so that they wouldn't foul, and just he was able to hit that shot, was one of the most, like, Ray Allen-esque, where the whole arena could not believe he hit that shot. And the 11 points at the end of the third quarter there going into the fourth was electric. Kobe White, can the Bulls front office get fired again for that trade with Kobe White? When they got Kobe White, I was just like, man, that's all that they had to send over to Chicago to get Kobe White, and he's been awesome for them. And like you pointed out, Dan, he is kind of the straw that stirs the drink when LaMelo Ball is not on the floor, and he was unreal in that game.
Yeah, I mean, I probably shouldn't take too demonstrative a victory lap, because he was on the floor when Konka Knipl wasn't, and we had the whole Konka Knipl Rookie of the Year conversation, and then he hasn't made a shot since, I don't think. Kobe White component of it has been, yeah, he was sensational. I mean, there were jokes to be thrown about, like, you know, play-in game veteran Kobe White, you know, with the Bulls being sort of the ancestral homeland of the play-in game. And plenty of experience playing against the Heat, who also are forever in the playing game. But they needed somebody to make shots, especially, yeah, they were really stagnant. They were having such a hard time generating good looks in the second half. And I believe 17 of his 19 points are in that second half, only turned the ball over once. He played 26 minutes and they were plus 21 in them. And obviously that shot was, you know, an absolutely electric shot that they had to have there at the end of the game. So yeah, I mean, this is why they knew they needed another ball handler, another shot creator, another guy that they could turn to make a shot late in the game. And I think like every time you looked over and said the camera went over and saw it showed Colin Knipl bummed out on the bench, it's like, yeah, but you know, this guy's in there to kind of do what they were looking for out of Khan that Khan wasn't able to do tonight, and certainly paid off for Charlotte there. And like, if you know, obviously if LaMelo's not going to be available, or if Colin Knipl is, you know, continues to struggle, which he has for the last, you know, few weeks coming down the stretch of the regular season, you'd imagine there's going to be more minutes, more opportunities, and they're going to be more of a need for shot creation and shot making from Coby White. Looks like he's certainly equal to the task, or was at least in the first play-in game there.
Can you walk me through the Amazon Prime snafu that happened? What was your experience with that?
Yeah, so when it went to overtime and you got to the point where I believe that it was because there's the staggered tips, right? You've got the East Coast game, the West Coast game early and late. Yeah. And I believe that when it got to 10:15 Eastern, it was like, well, this is when the changeover needs to happen. And rather than being able to say, we're going to start this one on ESPN2, or we're going to start this one on, you know, TBS, or we're going to start this one on True TV or whatever, it was just like two things trying to happen at the same time. And it kind of went like, whoops. And what you saw was just a technical difficulty screen. And it was one of the rare times in my life that me and LeBron James were doing the same thing at the same time, but watching it and going like, huh, something is amiss here. And it was about 2 minutes where it was off, and you had to like go back to the main screen and then go from the main broadcast down to a second thing and click around. And It wasn't great. We missed I believe a LaMelo Ball bucket early in overtime. That then you go back and review, and it's like, well, should that have been a travel? So we're missing live game action in a game of that.
Oh, you missed his D-cell? At
the slow step that looked like he might have hopped. Yeah, that first bucket, I believe, in overtime or second, whatever it was. I forget exactly when, but yeah, there was a chunk of time that all you had was a blue screen saying technical difficulties, and you know, not exactly a ringing endorsement for it, but the after the fact explanation was, I believe there was a hardware failure in the production truck. They got it fixed as quickly as they could, and they got back to seeing it. But yeah, there was a chunk of game time you just did not see, and not the maiden voyage that the Prime Video crew was looking for, I'm sure, to introduce into the postseason. But you know, hey, we're working things out. There's a couple of days before the first day of like proper playoff action. So hopefully, whatever redundancy systems need to be put into place, they will look to do that between now and then. But yeah, missing. I guess if you had to miss anything, it's better that than like the Coby White shot or the Tyler Hero three or the game winner and then game sealing block. Like, it wasn't like it blew out during that, but probably would be better to not have any of it happen. But you know, it's easy for me to say. I'm not a live TV producer.
Yeah, having been on these broadcasts, there's so much that goes into going on air that I had no idea until I could see, kind of peek behind the curtain on literal semi trucks in the arena that are filled with switches and boards and wires that they travel around the country in order to just be able to broadcast a game. And so much of it is just it's a tightrope act. So one thing I want to point out here is that short-circuited, Colin Knipl short-circuited too in this game, where he was just not effective. And in this story that I'm about to hit publish on, I'm saying that playoff experience is overrated and inexperience is the new thing. Well, Colin Knipl, I think a lot of those Duke White Lotus memes were going around when Colin Knipl was really struggling in this, because it felt like he hasn't been right for weeks now. And in the biggest moment, the Charlotte Hornets seem to shrivel up. 0 for 6 from downtown, 2 of 12 from the field, 6 points and 34 minutes. He was struggling. And Charles Lee made the tough decision to bench him in a lot of big moments and have Coby White out on the floor or Sion James out on the floor. Sion James taking the ball out on a lot of possessions to get the right pass, leaning on a rookie to do those in those big moments. Coach Lee was making a lot of points in the post-game press conference to shout out Sion James, who is, you know, kind of this unsung guy for the Hornets, a rookie who played at Duke, but simply came up big in those big moments. I would just say, for Con Knipple's sake and LaMelo Ball's sake, thank goodness for Kobe White, because that was an incredible performance that saved them. A great layup, but man, James Borrego, he got let go after the second play-in loss with LaMelo Ball, and it felt like we were heading to our third playoff loss watching LaMelo Ball. And they did a great job coming back in that game. But I love the play-in tournament for this reason. I don't love that it stratifies the NBA, that a lot of teams just decide halfway through the season, the 10th seed is really not worth it. We're just going to go tank for, you know, lottery positioning. But when you have these stakes, win or go home, it is so much fun. And I want more of that in the NBA schedule. I don't want to wait until April before we have real stakes in these games. So Dan, I think just a big victory for the NBA last night and a big victory for the play-in tournament. It was awesome and a great way to start off the postseason.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're doing this a few hours before night two of the play-in, where you've got Philly and Orlando and the Warriors and the Clippers. So plenty to live up to there. I mean, just selfishly, I would say if we could not have everything come down to the final possession at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, like that would be good for me personally. Just as somebody who's got a lot of writing to do and not a lot of sleep to do it. If that's where it comes down to, that'll be my cross to bear. And I somehow think I'll get through it.
Awesome game. Buzz City is back. It was, I think, like a moment for the whole entire region. Just felt like this relief wash over us, because we've, for the last two decades, we've been hearing about how the Hornets are the laughingstock of the league and the play-in tournaments have not been kind. And yet, it is a great basketball state. And with Duke and Carolina, NC State, Wake, of course, college basketball, Charlotte is a haven of great basketball. And it's great to see the Hornets have been on a tear over the last few months, something we've dug into a lot on this program. And hopefully we'll dig into it some more if they continue this run. And they got a win on Friday. So we'll find out who their opponent is. And we'll be back next week for another edition of The Big Number. Want to give a shout out to Brad, to Ryan, and the whole team behind the scenes making this show a reality. Thank you so much. The playoffs are here. Postseason is here. We got a great San Antonio Spurs, Portland Trailblazers matchup. And can't wait to see how this Charlotte Hornets story ends. We'll have more next week. Dan, enjoy playing night number two, and hopefully we get another thriller, but on the earlier side for you.
Just like a little honk shoe mode for your boy. Come on. That's all. Steph, let's go night early, Steph. That's all I'm asking for, all right?
Yes. Yes. You and LeBron have the same moments, and you and Steph also having similar moments where you want to go night. All right. Thanks so much, Dan, and thanks everybody for watching. See you next week.